Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Death in Briar Bottom, the true story of hippies, mountain lawmen, and the search for justice in the early 1970s, by Timothy Silver, narrated by Andre Bellido. Who Breaks a Butterfly Upon a Wheel? Alexander Pope, Epistle to Dr. Arbuthnot, 1735. Prologue. I thought they were going to shoot us all. By 10:30 on that summer night in 1972, the party at the remote woodland campsite had run out of steam. Beer cans littered the ground. Garbage bins overflowed with discarded food, greasy paper plates, plastic cups, and other refuse. Every now and then, the faint stench of overused pit toilets drifted across the clearing. About half of the 25 men and women staying there had gone to bed, but those awake were in good spirits. They were young, ranging in age from 16 to 26, and all but one came from Central Florida, around Clearwater. 2 days of hard driving had brought them here, to Yancey County, deep in the North Carolina mountains, a place so different from their hometown that it seemed like another planet. Surrounded by some of the highest peaks in Eastern America, their 7 vehicles, 6 cars and a Volkswagen van, sat parked in a grassy field, flanked on all sides by tall hemlocks, yellow birches, large leafy oaks, and giant poplars. The South Tow River, a clear, cold, boulder-strewn stream, flowed right past their campsite. Local people called the place Briar Bottom. It was the week of July 4th, pinnacle of the tourist season, and it had been tough to find a place to stay. Fortunately, they made a new friend at a local store who told them about Briar Bottom and agreed to meet them there. The Florida kids had to drive their vehicles across a shallow ford in the river, unload in the field, and carry their gear into the woods to make camp. Even then, they were not alone. Several families, a couple of college students, and 3 men from Orlando, Florida, had already parked vans in the meadow or set up tents among the trees along the river. But the place was beautiful, everything they had hoped for when they left Clearwater, and they settled in for the night. That afternoon, 3 of the guys drove to Asheville and returned with 17 6-packs of Budweiser and 2 bottles of Jack Daniels. They already had a stash of marijuana and some mild hallucinogens, all brought from home in anticipation of the week's activities. Once the alcohol arrived, someone set a couple of speakers atop the van and cranked up a tape player. Out in the open field, kids danced and flirted, shouting or singing along when a favorite tune came up on the tape deck. In a group that large, people tended to hang around those they knew best, congregating in small clusters, talking, laughing, smoking, drinking, just getting off on the beer, the dope, the mountains, and each other. Stanley Altland, the 20-year-old who had organized the trip, enjoyed a good outdoor party as much as anyone. But he took it easy that night. He drank a couple of beers and had a hit or two off the joints his friends passed around. But mostly, he just wandered about, chatting with the others. He ate supper with David Satterwhite, the boy from North Carolina who had guided them to Briar Bottom, an experienced camper. Satterwhite had his own van, a motorcycle, and a big white dog. Stan also spent time with Kim Burns, a tall, attractive 18-year-old woman from Clearwater he had begun dating a few weeks earlier. Altland had shoulder-length blonde hair, a scruffy beard, and wore round, wire-rimmed glasses to correct severe astigmatism. He frequently dressed in bib overalls and old work boots purchased from second-hand stores. Most of the Clearwater kids thought he was the walking definition of cool, a much-coveted youth descriptor in 1972. For Stan, being cool was more than a matter of style. He believed that young people like him, those others derisively labeled hippies, were pointing the way to a better world. Back home, he and his business partners had recently opened Clearwater's first health food store. Stan hoped it would one day become a true community center, and a vehicle for cultural, economic, and political change. He invited local artists, craftspeople, and filmmakers to display their work there. His friends loved the place. An hour or so after dark, Altland walked over to the VW van to talk with his pal, Phil Loki. Phil also wore wire-rimmed hippie glasses and had a beard and long dark hair that he often pulled back behind his ears. He and Stan had once been roommates, but several months earlier, Phil had moved to the bungalows, a string of run-down 2-bedroom dwellings on the outskirts of Clearwater. The bungalows had a well-deserved reputation as a hippie hangout, where the tenants threw raucous weekend parties. Several other residents had joined the outing to North Carolina, including Kevin Shea, Max Johnson, Ron Olson, and Gary Graham, four more 20-year-olds with well-worn clothes and shoulder-length locks. 18-year-old Sue Cello, who described herself as a Catholic schoolgirl with a mouth to match, had also come along. Over the course of the evening, Kevin Shea partook liberally of the beer and pot, found a stick, and announced that he was off to the woods to hunt rattlesnakes. Max Johnson and several women left for a night hike up a nearby hillside, carrying a bottle of Jack Daniels. Sue Cello joined a few others around a small campfire at the edge of the woods. Ron Olson and Gary Graham headed for their tents. It was that kind of mellow do-your-own-thing night. Most of those present thought it better to get too stoned than too drunk. Much cooler to toke up with friends around the fire than end up puking in the bushes or sitting alone in a car sorting out the kaleidoscopic images brought on by heavier drugs. But if hard drinking or stoned snake hunting happened to be your trip, no one would stand in your way. On July 3, 1972, the prevailing party ethic, to the extent that one existed, might well be summed up by that famous line from Bob Dylan, "Either be groovy or leave, man." By 11, temperatures dipped into the low 60s at Briar Bottom, sending more campers to their tents and sleeping bags. Heavy dew covered the ground, and anyone who strayed from the fire could see their breath in the thick, humid air. Filmy clouds drifted across a half moon. Stan Altland left the van and found a place to stretch out under a small tree. Kim Burns decided to join him, at least for a while, if the bugs were not too bad. Phil Loki walked out to his car to retrieve his bedroll. Eight or nine others lingered around the campfire. They had turned off the music and were talking quietly, sipping beer and smoking cigarettes. Sue Cello was still there, along with David Satterwhite and his dog. Donald Porter, whom everyone called Pooney, was at the fire pit too, a 26-year-old Vietnam veteran recently turned beach hippie. He was a regular at bungalow parties. With his long hair pulled into a ponytail that stretched well down his back, Pooney was the likable old man of the group. Just as a few of those at the fire began to doze, two of the girls glimpsed some flickering lights on the other side of the river, near the ford. Headlights from vehicles on the access road? Maybe some late-arriving campers looking for a site. They would have fun negotiating that rocky stream bed in the dark. Max Johnson was too sleepy to care. Returning from the night hike, he spread a sleeping bag on the ground and crawled inside. Somewhere nearby, Kevin Shea, still in search of venomous reptiles, howled like a wolf. As Phil Loki walked back from his car, he saw two pickup trucks with their headlights off drive quickly across the river and pull into the parking area. Seven men jumped out. Even in the dark, Phil could tell they were heavily armed. They moved through the trees like a SWAT team, and he heard them racking shotguns as they advanced on the Clearwater campsite. What the hell? For a second, Loki thought maybe he should make a break for it, just run as fast as he could into the forest, but he could not make himself move. At the campfire, Satterwhite's dog growled, waking its sleeping owner. Without warning, five of the armed men came out of the woods and surrounded the group at the fire pit. Caught completely off guard, the half-inebriated, half-stoned, drowsy campers tried to make sense of the abrupt turn of events. It seemed crazy, dreamlike, surreal. The men looked to be in their 30s or 40s, with short hair, dressed mostly in civilian clothes. One, who wore a yellowish-brown attire, appeared to be in charge. He mumbled something like, "What's the problem?" or "Do you have a problem?" or "What's the trouble here?" No one could be sure exactly what he said. But one thing was certain. The men all had pistols, and three of them wielded short-barreled 12-gauge shotguns. Without identifying themselves, the armed visitors fanned out around the camp, turning on flashlights, beating on tents, kicking at those asleep on the ground, and poking them with nightsticks. The good vibes from earlier in the evening instantly evaporated. Max Johnson and several others crawled from their sleeping bags, weak-kneed, shaking uncontrollably from the late-night chill and sudden anxiety. As one of the group later recalled, "We were scared to death. We didn't know what was happening, but we figured some kind of bad shit was about to go down." 30 yards away, the other two men, both carrying sawed-off shotguns, confronted Phil Loki. They said nothing, but as Phil noted, "You didn't have to be a genius to tell they were cops of some sort, and we were about to get busted." He asked the man closest to him, "Sir, could you please tell me what's going on?" He grabbed Loki, slapped handcuffs on him, and said, "I'll tell you exactly what's going on." Then he stuck his shotgun in Phil's back and marched him toward the campfire. Unbeknownst to the campers, the men rousting them were, at least for that night, duly sworn agents of the Yancey County Sheriff's Department. Sheriff Kermit Banks, the man in buff-colored clothing, led the raiding party. The posse included his brother Robert, four deputies, and a town cop from Burnsville, the Yancey County seat. On the sheriff's orders, the lawmen began rounding up all the campers so that they could be searched. Robert Banks shoved Pooney Porter against a big tree. Two deputies found Kevin Shea at the edge of the woods. They took a snake stick and made him stand next to Porter. A moment later, someone kicked Kim Burns in the back of the neck. She and Stan Altland scrambled to their feet to see what was going on. Stan put his hands in the air and urged everyone else to do likewise, imploring his friends to just be cool and do what they say. Then he appealed to the cops. "Hey man, we're harmless. We don't want to hassle with you." It made no difference. Using nightsticks to keep the campers in line, the lawmen began frisking both men and women, collecting pocket knives, keychains, even hairpins. They asked repeatedly about drugs, but found nothing except a bottle of prescription medicine one of the women had in her pocket. They took it. Waiting to be searched, Phil Loki glanced back toward the fire and saw Sheriff Banks in a heated argument with David Satterwhite. From 20 feet away, Loki could not hear what either man said. But he could tell that Banks was really pissed off, mad as hell. Apparently, when the sheriff asked Satterwhite to get up so he could be searched, the young man did not move. Instead, he insisted that he had done nothing wrong and added, "My dad and I camp here all the time." According to Satterwhite, Banks told him to put that goddamn dog up, or he would shoot it. The young man tethered the canine to a tree and pointedly asked, "Don't I have any rights?" Banks allegedly responded, "No, you don't," and turned his shotgun on the youth. Satterwhite then asked the sheriff to please put that gun away, and twice pushed the weapon aside. Phil Loki strained to get a better view. He could not believe that this skinny North Carolina teenager would argue with an angry sheriff holding a loaded 12-gauge. At that point, a deputy struck Phil with a shotgun and told him to stand up straight. The same officer frisked Stan Altland and Kim Burns and sent them over to stand near Pooney Porter and Kevin Shea. What happened next would be disputed for years, but according to the eyewitnesses from Clearwater, Sheriff Banks stuck his shotgun in Satterwhite's stomach and told him to get up against the big tree. Perhaps thinking the young man did not move fast enough, the sheriff reportedly raised the gun and, with a slashing motion, struck Satterwhite on his left arm with the butt of the weapon. The 12-gauge went off with a deafening roar, echoing across the quiet campground like a thunderclap. As the campers tell it, Stan Altland was standing 18 feet away when 9 pellets of double-aught buckshot, each as large as a .32-caliber bullet and capable of penetrating a car door, slammed into the left side of his chest and neck. The impact lifted him off his feet and sent him flying backward. Unable to regain his footing, he gasped and stammered, "Oh my God! Somebody help me!" as he slumped to the ground. Two women near Stan felt his blood splatter onto their clothes. Others screamed, "Jesus, no! No, no!" as Pooney Porter and Max Johnson rushed to Altland's side. Porter tore off Stan's shirt, wadded it into a ball, and held it tightly on the wound, trying to stanch the blood now streaming onto the ground. Pooney had seen plenty of gunshot victims in Vietnam, and he could tell Stan was badly hurt. About a third of his neck and chest had been blown away. Stan tried to speak, but only gurgled and coughed up blood. Kim Burns dropped to one knee and held his hand. Sue Cello stood nearby, screaming and crying. Pooney put his head to Altland's chest and listened for a heartbeat. He heard nothing. Stan's eyes flickered briefly and became fixed in his head. 3 bystanders saw smoke rising from the sheriff's gun as he pulled another shell from his pocket and reloaded his weapon. Apparently in shock, the deputies all stared in silence as Altland's blood pooled on a patch of dark green moss beneath the tree. As Loki described it, the cops just flipped out. They had no idea what to do. After what seemed like 3 minutes, the sheriff told Pooney, Max, and the others to get away from Stan. Panks instructed all the campers to sit down, telling them that Altland would get no help until they did. Still handcuffed, Phil thought, They were going to shoot us all and bury us in the woods. I thought I was dead. He fought off a wave of nausea and felt faint, but as he started to pass out, he fell against another camper and never lost consciousness. Instead, he watched helplessly as Stan lay on the ground for what seemed like another 15 minutes, blood seeping ever more slowly from what was left of his chest and neck. Finally, a Forest Service ranger who had been waiting near the river ford drove up in one of the pickup trucks. Banks and three of his men wrapped Altlin in a blanket, dragged him across the ground, and dumped him into the truck bed. The remaining campers, who just minutes earlier had been asleep or relaxing around the fire, looked on in horror as the vehicle rolled away with their friend. Suchello could no longer contain herself. Red-faced, wiping away tears, she screamed at the lawman, "You shot him! Fuck you, you bastards!" Kim Burns and several others just wailed in utter despair. Pooney Porter later called it the sickest scene I've seen since Vietnam. No one who witnessed it would ever be the same. Chapter 1. Absolution and Obsession. 2 days after that shotgun went off in Briar Bottom, I woke mid-morning at my home in Raleigh, some 240 miles away. That summer, at age 17, I worked the afternoon shift at a local A&P supermarket and usually spent my mornings lounging around the house, reading the Raleigh News and Observer. Since I rarely stirred before 10 a.m., my father always went through the newspaper first and then put the pages back together for me. But on that day, he left the Observer open to page 8, where I could not help but notice a bold headline, "Florida Youth Slain at Yancey Campsite." Wondering why the paper had been left in such unaccustomed disarray, I started reading. 5 paragraphs in, a single line stopped me cold. Stan Altland and his friends had gone on an outing to camp in the mountains, and later attended a Rolling Stones concert in Charlotte. A couple of months earlier, when I learned that the Rolling Stones were coming to Charlotte, I had begged my parents to let me go. I had promised to pay all my expenses, including a hotel room for the night. The parental verdict was a resounding no. I was crushed. For weeks, I had imagined what it would be like to be on the road with a couple of friends, windows down, music blaring, worried about nothing except getting to the concert on time. Instead, with the big event now a day away, I sat at home in a deep adolescent funk, anticipating nothing more than another afternoon of bagging groceries and mopping floors. My father knew all that when he left the News and Observer open that morning. He wanted to make sure that I saw what happened to those kids from Clearwater. He could not know that their story would become so deeply entwined with my own. Since 1967, we had lived in South Raleigh, where my dad served as pastor at a mid-sized Southern Baptist church. Like others who came of age in those years, I had seen the nation absorb one devastating shock after another. Assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, race riots, and the violence that accompanied mandatory school integration. Alabama Governor George Wallace ran for president in 1968 and 1972, promising that if he got elected, black children would never go to school with whites. His message had a lot of appeal in our neighborhood. The closest high school was predominantly black, but the district had been gerrymandered so that my friends and I attended a mostly white county school. Lots of parents grew increasingly nervous as Raleigh's black residents moved out from downtown and even closer to our segregated enclave. A man down the street had a 1960 Cadillac covered with Wallace's "Stand Up for America" stickers. On top of all that, there was Vietnam. Richard Nixon had vowed to end the war by turning the whole enterprise over to the South Vietnamese. But in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers, classified government documents that revealed how U.S. presidents had taken the country deeper into the conflict, knowing all the while that prospects for victory were bleak. For some reason, Nixon still seemed to think he could win, and ordered yet another American offensive in early 1972. Anti-war protests erupted across the nation. Bank heists, shootouts, and random bombings became commonplace, as radical groups like the Black Panthers and Weathermen tried to foment worldwide revolution. On some level, I understood that the demonstrations and violence stemmed from deep rifts between young and old, urban and rural, black and white, over basic notions of right and wrong in American society. Today's media calls those battles culture wars, but no one used that phrase in the early 70s. Few people at my high school talked much about current events either. thanks to a couple of student teachers. I had read Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, and Alex Haley's The Autobiography of Malcolm X. I like to think of myself as sympathetic to civil rights and black power. But I did not rush into the streets to rail against injustice or protest American aggression in Vietnam. As self-absorbed as any teenager, I spent my time hanging out with friends. That summer, we often gathered at the Cardinal Theater near the North Hills shopping mall, where weekend late shows, beginning at 11:30 p.m., catered to disaffected youth. Second-run anti-establishment films like Easy Rider, Vanishing Point, and Strawberry Statement drew kids from across the city. All those movies had a similar theme: peaceful young people harassed by local rednecks, cops, or campus police. With a bit of forethought, you could get a girl to stash a quart of Colt 45 malt liquor or Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine in her shoulder bag before entering the theater. When the lights went out, the drinking started, usually with multiple moviegoers sipping from the same container. Sneaking in pot was riskier, but not impossible, and occasionally a whiff of burning marijuana filtered through the darkness. House parties hosted by teens with absent parents were also good places to meet friends that summer. Beer and wine flowed freely. Kids smoked joints in their cars or found some out-of-the-way spot where they could take a hit off someone's bong. Couples retreated to back seats in back bedrooms, favored venues for what remained of the sexual revolution. We all lived in fear of being found out by parents or police. Drug laws had loosened a bit, but simple possession of marijuana could still land a first-time offender in jail. The drinking age for beer and wine was 18, meaning that a lot of us imbibed illegally. But we knew the places that sold alcohol without checking ID, and self-styled outlaw status was part of the attraction. As a preacher's kid, I had to be especially careful. What passed for normal teenage misbehavior in other households could quickly set the congregational tongues wagging, and might cost my dad his job. Not that the all-white Baptist faithful were paragons of Christian virtue. When my father delivered a sermon mildly critical of racism and violence, we got hang-up calls in the middle of the night. Sometimes an angry voice spat out, "N-word lover," before the line went dead. Such incidents only fueled my growing distaste for hypocrisy and pretense, both of which seemed to be everywhere that summer. Like a generation of young people before us, we took refuge in rock and roll, but we no longer harbored any illusions that peace, love, and music could change the world. Despite all the protests, the war showed no signs of ending. San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, once the epicenter of countercultural flower power, had collapsed into drug-saturated ruin. The Beatles, who had proclaimed "All You Need Is Love," were defunct. Torn apart by jealousy, infighting, and John Lennon's affinity for opiates, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison were dead, victims of heroin and barbiturates. Woodstock might have promised a better world a-comin', but that rock-inspired, drug-infused utopia had yet to show up. My crowd preferred solo artists like Joe Cocker, whose soulful take on the Beatles with a little help from my friends provided a fitting anthem for everyday life. We liked Leon Russell, who understood that we were all strangers in a strange land, and Neil Young, who felt like getting high, and excoriated the South for its long history of bigotry and racism. At house parties, blues-based hard rock from bands like Led Zeppelin and the Allman Brothers pulsed from oversized speakers. Those artists usually ignored politics in favor of lengthy guitar solos, screaming vocals, and a hypnotic backbeat. Nevertheless, hard rock became part of our identity, a way to set ourselves apart from supposedly less sophisticated listeners who preferred the top 40. Hard rock had a certain sameness that made it immediately recognizable. The Who said it best: "Don't raise your eye, it's only teenage wasteland." Black artists had also grown cynical about prospects for change. In 1970, Curtis Mayfield, who had once written hopeful tunes like "Keep On Pushing" and "People Get Ready," both favored by the civil rights movement, recorded a new song called "Don't Worry, If There's a Hell Below, We're All Going to Go." It seemed like a perfect assessment of the status quo. A year later, Marvin Gaye released "What's Going On." He intended the title as a statement, not a question. The album's lead track insisted that war is not the answer, and bluntly asked, "Who are they to judge us simply because our hair is long?" Other songs on the album chronicled the sad plight of heroin addicts, flying high in the friendly sky, warned of polluted oceans with "fish full of mercury," and recounted the suffering of the urban poor. Like everyone else, Gay could only say that it all makes me want to holler and throw up both my hands. No musicians, black or white, captured the cynicism and amorphous angst of the early 70s better than the Rolling Stones. With music rooted in Delta blues, American country, and early rock, mixed with a hint of gospel, the shaggy-haired Englishmen had always promoted themselves as the bad boys of rock and roll. Although the Beatles sold more records in the late 60s, Mick Jagger and his mates flourished with countrified hits like Honky Tonk Women, and electric rockers like Street Fighting Man, the unofficial theme song of American anti-war protesters. The band's 1969 song Gimme Shelter fit nicely with apocalyptic visions of the future, predicting that war, rape, and murder were just a shot away. The Stones had street cred, too. Founding member Brian Jones drowned in a swimming pool after swallowing a handful of amphetamines and quaaludes, washed down with half a bottle of whiskey. The coroner called it death by misadventure. Jagger and guitarist Keith Richards had both been busted for drugs, the latter more than once. Mick briefly dabbled in Satanism, something that only enhanced his anti-establishment image. The band's last trip to the States in 1969 had ended with the disastrous Altamont concert, in front of 300,000 volatile freaks awash in alcohol and acid. Four people died on site, including Meredith Hunter, a black man stabbed to death by Hell's Angels right in front of the stage. After that, Nixon put Jagger on the White House's enemies list, and the FBI tried to infiltrate the band's inner circle. None of that mattered to the Stones. They flew back to England with a fat suitcase full of cash, and ignoring the bad press, proceeded to make a movie about the ill-fated Altamont concert. Titled Gimme Shelter, it became both a critical success and a box office hit, not to mention a perennial favorite at Cardinal Theatre late shows. As far as anyone could tell, the Rolling Stones just did not give a shit, and among disenchanted youth, in Raleigh, Clearwater, and across America, that made the band unspeakably cool. When I read that News and Observer article, I knew that those kids from Florida had turned a pilgrimage to see the Stones into a week-long party. They were on the road, camping out, away from parental authority and the trappings of an oppressive, moribund society. I could easily picture them sitting around a campfire, a little buzzed from the alcohol and pot, full of anticipation, laughing, talking about which songs the Stones might play. They were living the dream, my dream, until the county sheriff showed up and turned it into a nightmare. That evening at the dinner table, when talk turned to the shooting, my parents, in that understated, we-know-best voice that teenagers loathe, said simply, "This is what we were worried about when you wanted to go to that concert. You just never know what might happen." For them, the story provided absolution. For me, it became an obsession. I could turn my back on Vietnam. I could ignore hypocrisy and racism. I could drop the needle on a record or plug in a tape and drown out all the political turmoil. But I could never forget those Florida kids who saw their road trip to see the Rolling Stones go so horribly wrong. My family moved later that summer, and I spent my senior year at a new high school in Burlington, North Carolina. I found another job bagging groceries and continued to live the paranoid double life of a preacher's kid turned hippie. I went to college and graduate school and enjoyed a long career teaching American history at Appalachian State, the largest university in western North Carolina. An avid outdoorsman, I visited Yancey County often, backpacking through the high mountains and fly fishing on the South Tow River. I frequently camped with friends in Briar Bottom and eventually wrote a book about the surrounding region. In time, I thought less about July 3, 1972, but more than once over the course of my academic career, I promised myself that one day I would put my historian skills to use and investigate the incident. Sometime in 2020, shortly before I retired from university life, I Googled shooting, Briar Bottom, Yancey County, NC, 1972. The search turned up a couple of newspaper articles, including the one my father had shown me almost 50 years earlier when I worked at the A&P. A bit more reading soon revealed that Stan Altland's death was not an isolated local incident. Events like Kent State and the FBI's relentless pursuit of black activists like Angela Davis made national news. But out of the spotlight, in small towns and rural areas across America, local police and sheriffs came down hard on young people
Sample complete. Ready to continue?